to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work or has some bearing on what they're doing. And today, I'm really excited to have director Liza Mandaloup here with me. Hi, Liza.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Happy to be here.
For those of you who aren't as familiar with Liza's work, please let me give you an introduction. Liza is an award-winning film director from New York, residing in Los Angeles. Starting her career in photography, she graduated from New York School of Visual Arts and embedded herself in fascinating communities for photo series that culminated in two books. And those photo books still available? Are they around?
Yeah, they actually are.
What are their names?
One is called A Place You Can't Find.
Okay.
And the other one is called Give Yourself to the Sea.
Okay.
Actually, Give Yourself to the Sea is sold out, but I do have...
Yeah, fuck you guys. Yeah, you didn't get it.
You can't get that anymore, but I do have a lot of copies of A Place You Can't Find, and I'll be happy to mail one to anyone who wants one.
So Liza's shown her work in numerous exhibitions as well. Her entry into the entertainment industry, however, came when she was working as a casting scout, serving as the main street scout for dozens of campaigns, films, and print ads. Through all of this, though, she was also shooting and directing films. Her short-form directorial debut, Twin Heads, following the band The Garden to dissect their art in twindom, premiered on Dazed Digital. Since then, she has been a longtime collaborator for many online platforms such as Vogue, Nowness, ID, and Dazed, as well as having directed numerous films for many other premier editorial platforms. She's also directed commercials, working with brands like Adidas, Gap, Chanel, Dove, Aveeno, Champs, and Delta Airlines. In 2018, Liza received the prestigious Sundance Documentary Fund grant for her film Jawline, following a handful of online teen heartthrob boys to chronicle the curious rise of a burgeoning yet fleeting economy. Jawline premiered at Sundance Film Festival and went on to win the Special Jury Award for Emerging Filmmaker. She was named by Filmmaker Magazine as one of the 25 new faces of independent cinema in 2018. And in 2019, she was named one of 10 documentary filmmakers to watch, and by watch I mean watch the movies you're up and coming by Variety. And then she's currently in production on her second feature film, which is documentary or narrative?
Documentary.
Right, okay, now. All right. So, Liza, the movie you chose to talk about today is Heathers. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Oh my God, I love this film so much. I think that I love the tone of it more than anything. And I feel like when I have ideas, I don't often think of like referencing it because I tuck it away.
Yeah.
But I find myself explaining tone. And then like when I think of the Heathers, I'm like, oh, like that tone, you know, where it's real, but it's not real. It's like imagined, but it plays out like reality. And it's abstracted, but not literally abstracted. Like you're just kind of trying to explain tone, and tone is so hard to talk about. It's much easier to, once you see it.
Yes.
And that was actually something that I struggled a lot with Jawline, with kind of putting the tone into words.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until it was completely done that people received it.
Yes.
And so I think I really just fell in love with this film in that way. But also the music. And I love Winona Ryder. She always plays my favorite characters in every movie.
For those of you who haven't seen Heathers, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching still. If you would like to pause and watch Heathers first, this is your chance. Now, let me introduce Heathers. Written by Daniel Waters and directed by Michael Lehman for release in 1989, Heathers stars Winona Ryder as Veronica Sawyer, a popular girl who hangs out with three rich and beautiful Heathers. Veronica, however, is becoming disillusioned with popularity.
Dear Diary, Heather told me she teaches people real life. She said, real life sucks losers dry. If you want to fuck with the Eagles, you have to learn to fly. I said, so, you teach people how to spread their wings and fly? She said yes. I said, you're beautiful.
The arrival of a new student, JD, played by Christian Slater, gives her a relief from the Heathers. Heather Chandler, the big Heather, gets angry at Veronica one night when she refuses to have sex with a frat boy at a party. Instead, Veronica sleeps with JD. The next morning, they break into Heather Chandler's house to prank her with a gross hangover cure. But JD fills a mug with drain cleaner, and Heather drinks it, killing her instantly.
I can't believe it. I just killed my best friend.
And your worst enemy.
Same difference.
Veronica forges a suicide note, and they leave as if nothing had happened. Veronica is almost exhilarated by the experience. Perhaps all the cruelties of high school will change with Heather Chandler gone. Everyone takes up Heather Chandler's suicide, then, as a call to arms, led by a woo-woo teacher at the school.
We must revel in this revealing moment. Look, I suggest that we get everybody together, both students and teachers, in the cafeteria, and just talk and feel together.
Thank you, Miss Fleming. You call me when the shuttle lands.
But Heather Duke, one of the lower Heathers, steps in to pick up the slack as torturer-in-chief. Soon, Veronica's rep is slandered by two jocks who spread a rumor she gave them a blowjob. JD convinces Veronica they need to lure these guys to the woods and shoot them with fake bullets once their pants are dropped. Only, JD loaded the guns with real bullets. Veronica misses her boy, and JD chases her guy back to her, and she makes the fatal decision to shoot him, making her truly culpable in the crime. They plant gay porn by their bodies and forge another suicide note. Now the school takes up the jocks' deaths as a means to rail against homophobia. Meanwhile, Martha Dump Truck, an actually depressed suicidal kid, tries to kill herself walking into traffic, but survives and is then ridiculed as trying to act like the popular kids. One night, Heather McNamara, Yellow Heather, calls into a radio show to talk about her own suicide ideations.
God has cursed me, I think.
The last guy I had sex with
killed himself the next day. Failing math. My whole life is a mess.
Heather Duke tells the whole school, and Veronica has to stop Heather McNamara from swallowing a bunch of pills in a lovely little scene between the two of them. Veronica tells JD she's done with him. Later that night, he climbs into her room to kill her, but she's staged herself hanging, and he confesses to what he thinks is a dead Veronica that he got everyone in school to sign a mass suicide note so he can blow the place up the next day.
We students of Westerberg High will die. Today, our burning bodies will be the ultimate protest to a society that degrades us. Fuck you all. It's not very subtle, but neither's blowing up a whole school now, is it?
At school, Veronica finds JD in the boiler room, and a fight ensues between them. She stops the bomb, but JD follows her outside of the school with another one strapped to his chest and detonates it. Veronica, tired of this bullshit, takes Heather Duke's red scrunchie and tells her,
Heather, my love, there's a new sheriff in town.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
So good.
One of the things I want to talk about is the impetus for Daniel Waters to make this, which was, in a sense, it was a backlash against John Hughes films. He said, quote, the teen films of the time, the John Hughes film, you know, they were fun. But there's a whole other wing of the high school they weren't going into, the dark Stephen King wing that no one wanted to look at. And I think Heather's was refreshing. It was the first time a lot of people lost their dark humor virginity. It's hard to even remember now that going back then, there were so many television shows and documentaries about the horror of teen suicide that just made it so attractive to commit suicide because you got all this love and adulation. Who can resist? It seemed like I was the only one noticing the humor in it. The actual first line I wrote was, quote, you can't use that knife, it's filthy, when Veronica and JD are going to stage Heather Duke's suicide. It took off from that. So I would love to talk about your feelings on dark humor virginity and, you know, going into the darkness of high school and teens. You know, is it off limits? Is it what we should be exploring more of?
I think it's authentic. I mean, for me, like when I was a teenager, it was a pretty dark time. I mean, you're so overwhelmed by everything that you, and everything feels so extreme. And you, I think there's like some part in the movie where they say like, you always have the option to kill yourself or something. And it's like, I mean, as a teenager, you literally feel that way.
Yeah.
Like I watch the film and I'm like, it's so ridiculous, but so spot on.
Yes.
It's like, these are actually, it's like you, if you take the way that teenagers feel when they're in high school and you put it into characters, like he did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of feel like the joke is on other people where it seems so ridiculous and so extreme and stuff. But it's like I don't feel like any of the things they're saying is untruthful to how like the teenage experience is.
I mean, you feel like I always felt like a cat on drugs when I was a teenager. Yeah. Like if I look back at it in retrospect, I was like my brain was moving way too fast. Shiny things, constant distractions, thinking about sex, thinking about like, you know, whatever dark shit was there.
Yeah. And also just thinking about like how to get out of it. You know, and you kind of I actually also like Christian Slater's character. He's like this like savior. And I remember feeling that way in high school. And I'm sure a ton of people do where it's like you almost wish like, can someone please just come and take me out of this situation?
Yeah.
And I feel like he plays this like savior character where he's what Winona Ryder's character was fantasizing about having.
Yeah.
Like she was so sick of this act she was putting on, and here he comes in and he calls bullshit and he does all the things that she wants to do.
Yeah.
And I always felt like he was like imagined by her the whole time.
Oh, I like this reading of it where maybe Christian Slater's character is just like a weird cipher of a person. Almost like drop dead Fred, just a figment of her imagination.
I totally read him like that the whole time.
I did not know this. All right, now I'm gonna think about it. I feel like I can relate a lot of this to your movie in terms of, you know, our kind of Christian Slater character. Your film Jawline features a person, a guy, a young guy who finds these kind of internet hero boys, you know, and kind of turns them into profit centers in a sense. Michael, I believe. Is that his name?
Yeah, Michael.
He's kind of like fulfilling these desires of these people, you know, these young boys who want to win like stardom and get money just from like giving all of these young women, you know, positive affirmations and talking to them online. And I feel like he is kind of a Christian Slater.
Hey, he just like says it like it is, like how nobody really wants to say it.
Yeah.
And people kind of are shocked by him in that way where it's like, oh, my God, like, are you evil?
Yeah.
You know, they kind of think he's evil because of all the things he's saying. But I never felt like he was evil. I felt like he was the keeper of the knowledge, kind of where he understood what it took. And he was looking at everybody like they were figures that he was kind of playing with to see like who could grow, who's going to fall off, get rid of them, bring this one in, maybe he'll replace that one. And it was very it was all like a numbers game kind of to him.
But it's almost, I mean, that's why I think we're, you know, as an audience member watching a movie, I'm drawn into him because he is honest.
Exactly.
He's the only one who's honest, whereas there's a lot of bullshit that you get from, you know, the kind of teen stardom thing of, you know, just like boys looking pretty and having to like...
I think people are uncomfortable with dissecting that age for what it is.
Yeah.
Especially in the doc space. I think that people, like when you're a teenager, you can speak for yourself and you have like adult feelings and emotions, but you are technically under the guardianship of a parent.
Yeah.
And so it's this very gray area where it's like, do I talk to you like an adult? And do I access what's really going on in your head like I would an adult? Or do I have to kind of keep it in this safe space that's like parental friendly and stuff?
Totally.
But then once you treat a teen like that, you get these answers that you would get as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I don't naturally talk to anybody that way. I'm like, my approach to the whole thing was, I'm going to talk to you like I would talk to anybody. I'm not going to censor myself, and I'm not going to make you censor yourself, and I'm not going to make you feel like you need to, you know, have the permission of an adult to say what you want to say to me and stuff. And I think that that feels like taboo to some people.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's the only way to get to some sort of truth in that world. And I don't know. I feel like I wished so badly that someone would talk to me like that as a teenager.
Yeah.
So I think that I kind of was well received when I talked to people like
that.
Well,
it's not even talking. I would say it's listening, you know.
Exactly.
And that's something also that Daniel Waters, when he was writing this, he was lifting lines from people, actual young people that he was listening to, where he was just like, your vocabulary is weird. I want to seize this and I want to move it around. And I feel like because it's timeless, because it doesn't actually exist, this vocabulary that he's creating, then everyone's going to grab onto it because it will be timeless. It'll be like, yeah. Oh, okay. So for instance, quote, he said, "It's embarrassing because I stole a lot of my lines. What's your damage? I stole from when I was a camp counselor. And one of my little camper girls, Jamie, used to say, 'What's your damage?' I just completely stole that from her. And one of my college friends used to say, 'Fuck me gently with a crowbar.' And then I realized crowbar sounded too masculine. Chainsaw was more feminine. And apparently, 'fuck me gently' was at one time a common expression in England. This is the evolution of nasty language. That's what my friend extrapolated 'fuck me gently' into 'fuck me gently with a crowbar.' And then I had to have him killed so I could take credit."
Oh, my God. Amazing.
So, you know, he's listening and he's kind of taking the history of language and he's putting it into this movie. But it's like what you said earlier. It is a surreal movie, but there's a kind of realness to it.
That makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. And I think that it like, whatever he did, it allowed the film to be timeless. Mm-hmm. Where I'm like, this is... And also, if you think about it, like, the stories of, like being a teenager are timeless. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of what is in Jawline, where it's, like, about modern technology, but it's an age-old tale.
Yeah.
And I feel like when I was rewatching Heather's for this, I was like, this is more relevant than ever.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will get into how this movie got made a little bit more. Okay. We'll be right back.
Listen, I'm a hotshot Hollywood movie producer. You have until I finish my glass of kombucha to pitch me your idea. Go.
All right, it's called Who Shot Ya, a movie podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes. I'm Iffy Whiteyway, the new host of the show and a certified BBN.
BBN?
Buff black nerd.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, an elderly gay and legit film critic who wrote a book on Christmas movies.
I'm Drea Clark, a loud white lady from Minnesota.
Each week, we talk about a new movie in theaters and all the important issues going on in the film industry.
It's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets Cruising.
And if it helps seal the deal, I can flex my muscles while we record each episode.
I'm sorry, this is a podcast? I'm a movie producer. How did you get in here?
Iffy, quick, start flexing.
Bicep, lats, chest. Who Shot Ya? Dropping every Friday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Liza Mandaloup, and we are talking about Heathers. So, as I said before, there's some interesting stuff about how this movie was made. For one, New World Pictures, which was making this movie, was like going bankrupt as it was putting this movie out. And it was a time when people were kind of taking chances on like, well, this is low budget. Nobody's going to care. And
was that low budget?
It was pretty low budget. I think it was, wow, like they had like maybe $4 million to
make
this movie.
They did a great job.
So I talked to the cinematographer, Francis Kenny, before, and he was saying that they ended up saving a lot of money, for instance, on sets because they built everything in a gymnasium for the most part. Every Heather, Veronica, they all shared the exact same room, and it was the same set, but they just repainted it and redecorated it for every different character. So anytime you're in a bedroom, then you're actually in the same set.
I always feel this way that like it's the more money you have, mm-hmm, it like it's just like the less creative you get. Like,
oh,
that's
yeah,
so creative to yeah, me, where it's like it looks the same as if they had twice the amount.
Yeah.
But they just had to be more creative and practical with what they had.
And it's actually kind of cool when you think about the fact that all the Heathers have the same bedroom, because then it gets into the identical nature of them as well.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah,
where like maybe you notice it, but you don't notice it.
And you don't question it.
Yeah.
You're like, of course, they like, you know, they're, yeah, all, they're all the Heathers.
Yeah,
it's
perfect.
Copy culture anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they did a series of these things, you know, corner cutting to get it done. And, you know, the script was very, very much in shape by the time that they had gotten it to this, you know, the production. We'll talk a little bit about that, the development of that script, because that's kind of funny too. But it's a low budget feature. New World Pictures didn't really care. It might have been one of the reasons why they went out of business. This was not a box office success. They clearly didn't have any marketing behind it when you're going bankrupt. Denise DeNovi, who was a producer on the project, said, "It was a nightmare. I paid for the ad in the LA Times myself for the second week. It was $1,800, which to me was like $18,000 at the time." And then Michael Lehman, the director, said, the movie didn't do a lot at the box office, but it did stay in the theaters for a while. It never made a profit. And Daniel Waters said, I made more money writing a treatment for Parent Trap 3 for the Disney Channel that never happened.
Oh, my God.
Pretty sad, right?
I feel you. This is just an age-old tale.
Yeah. I want to talk about, you know, you had mentioned Winona Ryder. So let's get into the casting of Winona Ryder. Because a few people had actually, you know, expressed interest. Jennifer Connelly, Justin Bateman, both rejected the role of Veronica, actually. And then Winona Ryder was next on the list, but Daniel Waters was like, the girl from Lucas, she's not attractive. And
oh my God. I have so many. And first of all, she is cute. Like,
she's
what
so
is
cute.
What is his taste?
But Winona Ryder had said, you have to understand, at that time, I didn't look that different from my character in Beetlejuice. I was very pale. I had blue-black dyed hair. I went to Macy's at the Beverly Center and had them do a makeover on me before the reading.
So, oh, bless her.
No.
The good old Macy's counter.
Yep. Just helping her look the part.
Yeah.
But Denise DeNovi had said, Winona was so smart. She was 15. She turned 16 on the movie. She was a prodigy. From a very young age, she was an old soul. She really got the words and the imagery. She had watched tons of old movies. She was really sophisticated intellectually, and she had a beauty of Veronica. She had the intelligence. She was just the perfect anti-Heather.
She was 16?
Yeah, 15 when they started.
That's crazy, because usually high school movies, everyone's like ridiculously older. It's almost a joke where it's like you guys are like well into your 20s.
Yeah. And that's something that was a big thing for Michael Lehman and Daniel Waters, is they had seen the backlash, and they were of like people who were 20s playing in like their high school time. And they were like, we really do not fucking want to do this. Like, we want to have like actual kids in this movie.
I wonder if they understood like the bigger message of it when they were doing that. Wow, I'm really just.
I've got something for that, because Shannon Doherty did not fucking know anything. Michael Lehman said when Shannon came in, because she was already a star, our casting directors pulled me aside and said, this girl is really good, but she wants Veronica. And I said, we've already cast Winona. And they said, she knows that. She's willing to read the Heather Duke part, but she just wants you to know that that's not the part she wants. She was amazing in the reading. I think she actually came in hoping we'd think that she was so good that we'd give her the Veronica role. But then they were like, it's really good that we didn't, because she didn't fucking understand the movie at all. And that was like... really, really hard. There's some really...
Well, what did she think was going on?
So she just didn't get it. Because she just come off of Little House on the Prairie and Our House, which are like very wholesome things. And Denise DeNovi said, I don't think Shannon at the time quite got what Heather's was. And that actually worked for us. She made that character real, because she's like so... like she's just saying what she's saying. And then Shannon Doherty said, the first time I saw the movie, I was definitely a little bit in shock. It was so dark and so funny, and maybe a little over my head. And... Lizanne Falk said, people would laugh at things that you didn't think were that funny. I do remember Shannon just kind of going like, you've got to be kidding. She didn't realize it was a comedy, or maybe know what a dark comedy meant.
Oh my. I have actually had like experiences like that with subjects, though, where they watch the film and they're like, I had no idea it was going to be like that. And I'm like, but you're literally the ones in it.
You're
like,
driving it.
It's your life and your story. It's so, I think that people don't, you can't assume that everyone's like analyzing things, you know.
Yeah.
We're clearly, we do that clearly. Any filmmaker does that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, especially when I work with real people, it's like I find the most interesting people have no idea they're interesting.
Yeah.
It's like if someone, you know, kind of thinks there is that if you show up as a documentary filmmaker and the person kind of treats you like, well, I've been waiting my whole life for you to come here, you know, which I have had happen, where you like open the door and someone's like, I got to tell you about the film of my life that I always thought someone should make. Those things are never like the right people. But the my favorite people to work with are the people that are like, why do you guys keep coming back? I don't get it. Like, I'm definitely nothing's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you put it into like a film for them, they have like this outer body experience. It's like,
did you find that? I mean, like, so Jawline is that must have been harder, I would suppose, because there you are interviewing primarily people who think that they are stars or who that could they could become stars.
Yeah, I mean, they also, it was like I was entering their world of celebrity.
Yeah,
as someone that had no idea who they were.
Yeah,
and so it was definitely difficult because you got all the egos of celebrity.
Yeah.
But it just felt ridiculous at times where it's like, oh, I'm having such a hard time getting access to this like 16-year-old boy that like, you know, doesn't really do anything.
Yeah.
And it was definitely frustrating. I feel like those were like kind of like some of the hardest times because you just sometimes, I don't know, I think docs are just like their own beast, but sometimes you don't get respected in certain situations where you're like working really hard and then like someone kind of has their own like ego and agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think that dealing with that psychologically is so much of being a filmmaker.
Yes.
Where you're like, you're really asking a lot of someone, but you're also giving so much of your time. So you have to respect that maybe they don't think about your time and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But adding the layer of dealing with people that thought that they were like these big celebrities made that even more difficult.
Oh God, I can imagine. But I mean, that's what apparently a lot of people were dealing with Shannen Doherty.
Yeah.
Which Winona Ryder's like, she got a bad rap. She's not as bad as everyone said. You know, like she was like, but she was, I think 16 or 17 at the time. And she was like her mother presented her as a big star. Like, just so you know, she's a very big star. And I think that that's like maybe where things went wrong. Carrie Lynn, who played Martha Dunstock / Martha Dumbtrack, better known as, she was saying like, everyone was great. Shannen Doherty was a bitch.
She really was her character.
Yeah, she was like, but she also
I
just
love
didn't
Martha
know.
Martha Dumbstock saying that too.
Oh my God. And Carrie Lynn, who went on to be a comedian, she is a really fascinating person too. Michael Lehman said, the casting directors brought in actresses who were good looking but slightly chubby. I said, no, we need somebody who is really large. Carrie was completely invested in it. She understood what it's like to be teased. And Carrie Lynn said, I was doing stand-up at the time. That's how I first met the casting agent. I think most of it was that I looked the part. Where else are you going to find another 400-pound young person? I think I came out of the womb obese. I had no friends. I was Martha Dumptruck in real life growing up in Beverly Hills. And now I've got therapy.
She was the one of the most problematic characters to me, though.
Tell me about it.
I felt like she was so stereotypical that I couldn't really find like the deeper meaning in her. Like when she's like sitting on the bleachers and like spills Coke all over herself and just, you know, walks up to the popular kids at lunch and just everything about her was like, I was just like, oh, I feel like I almost felt like she didn't have that complexity that some of the other characters had where they reveal one side and then there's actually like another side to it where she was just like, let's like, you know, write the overweight, uncool girl to be, you know, she's always snacking and
oh, yeah,
you know, and following people. And I just so badly wanted her to be a bit more complex than
there
she was.
There's actually a scene that was taken out that they wouldn't let her have in an ending. She was supposed to have the very triumphant ending. And maybe that scene would have helped you with it. But Daniel Waters had written that the ending, I don't know if you know about the ending, but that there would be the bomb would go off. It would kill the entire school and they would have a prom in heaven. But
that is such a good ending.
But the thing is that there was another part of the ending that he was just like, okay, if I can't have that, let me at least have this. So he said that the ending I should have fought harder for is where Martha Dumptruck pulls out a knife, stabs Veronica and says, fuck you, Heather. And Veronica's on the ground laughing with a knife in her stomach saying, my name's not Heather. My name's not Heather. So at the end, you've got her kind of like in her like on her wheel thing.
Whoa, my mind is blown right now because that is such a good
ending.
Isn't
that a great ending?
It is so good, so smart, so complex, and also gives the power to the girl that should have had it in the first place.
And we would all get to cheer and we'd be like, yeah.
I feel deeply unsatisfied by that film's ending. And I didn't realize how unsatisfied I was until I had this conversation where I'm like, so Martha Dumptruck is in a wheelchair and just like scoots off with Winona Ryder?
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to feel any sort of feelings from that, and I at a certain point I thought that it was just kind of like you're not supposed to feel like any sort of cliche ending where you feel like I've gotten a great ending from this film, but I feel like she should have had some power at some point. And like how smart the whole script was, and now it makes me feel so much better that like the writers and chose like tried to do that.
Carrie Lynn signed up for that ending, and she was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna do this," you know. And Daniel Waters still, you know, today he wishes that that would have been the ending that he had fought for. If they can't have the high school prom in heaven, then she could have at least had her like revenge, you know.
It's crazy how like the industry makes you like fight for things too, or like you have like your that's so much of filmmaking. At large, it's
totally.
It's like what are you gonna fight for, and what are you not gonna fight for? You're kind of always trying to figure out how to manage those two things, and you kind of always hope that you fought for the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moment, sometimes you don't realize it. Like especially like an ending, you're just kind of like, well, I just want the damn thing made, you know?
Yeah, like, you'll take it because you're getting through, and you're like, okay, well, if they give me this money. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the iconic wardrobe of Heather's and a little bit about the kind of changing culture, you know, that happened in movies after Heather's became a cult hit. Okay, we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Hill from Show Business. And while I'm not from Canada, my grandfather, Clarence Vincent Blake Sr. was, and he wouldn't shut up about it. My grandfather moved on to that great penalty box in the sky way back in the 80s. Still, all these years later, I can't help but wonder, what do we really know about Canada and its people? Which is why my friend Chris Gersbeck and I decided to make So, You're Canadian. Brand new podcast from the Maximum Fun Network, on which I attempt to get to know our neighbors to the north, one Canadian at a time. Coming to Maximum Fun, August 27th. And I'm not sorry.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Liza Mandeloup, and we're talking about Heathers. So one thing that really irks Daniel Waters today, even. He said, quote, I think I did elevate the teen movie genre, but there came a point where in every high school thing, you know, every high school movie, people were talking above their IQ level like we did, and it got a little grating. It's a weird thing. That's fine that those movies come from Heathers, but I feel like even back in the day, movies about doctors and lawyers and journalists would be much more nuts and bolts about their job. Now I feel like all movies are high school movies. All TV shows about doctors and lawyers are the high school template put in a job setting. I feel like it's the one experience everyone knows. There's almost too much high school stuff going on. The Heathers template has gone into every genre. You can look at any TV show at a law firm and be like, oh, okay, these are the Heathers, and this is the Veronica, and this is the JD. Which I think he's got a point. I mean, I don't know that he's like self-aggrandizing necessarily, but I do think that there's a kind of division and a template that was adopted from a movie like this.
Do you think he invented that though? Like, I don't feel that way.
I think he's pulling from other things.
Yeah, I mean, of course, but I also think that he's be inspired by the structure of society.
Yeah.
So,
but I do think that his note, because one of the things that he was doing when he was writing the script was not writing for teens, writing for people who are extremely smart. So everyone in this school is extremely smart and saying all the comebacks, all the things that you wish you could think of, you know, like he wasn't trying to make it realistic. So it was kind of surrealism. But in that respect, I think he's even borrowing from the movies of like the 1930s, you know, these like really like Bogart Bacall movies, you know,
actors acting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I think is a really interesting thing. But the way that it was adopted for teen movies in particular is potentially true. You know, they're like, everyone's a precocious girl, a precocious boy, you know?
Yeah. But I think that that's why, like, I think that is the style of the movie, where mm-hmm. I think there's been, like, other movies since that aren't like that, that are more like a mumblecore feeling in high school yeah. and stuff. But I think that the reason that you can kind of psychoanalyze this movie is because it's like that, where I feel like everybody represents something very specific. They're not just there because they're there. Mm-hmm. They're there because they represent something bigger than themselves. And yeah. if you're going to represent something bigger than yourself, you have to say something like
that means
anything. It's complex. Yeah. Yes.
Like, your movie is showing that high school is different today, though, I would say, for instance, being that the community that you used to get solely in high school, you know, is actually potentially coming from other sources online. But it still can be just as toxic. It can still be just as good, but it's just in other places.
Yeah. And also, you don't feel as trapped necessarily, because you even, like, I mean, physical mobility is not, like, you can't, as, like, a young person, just leave. You don't mm-hmm. have money, you don't have means, but you could escape to the internet and to, like, to the world of social media and find, like, other people there that are not like the people you know. Mm-hmm. That feels new to me. That feels, because it feels real. It's like, it literally is an alternate reality.
Yeah.
So I think that is something that I've always thought was kind of positive, where it should lead to some sort of hopefulness mm-hmm. to know that, oh, okay, like, I don't like anyone in my town and everyone makes fun of me and I don't fit in. But when I go online, I feel like there's people that respect me and care about me.
Which we find in essentially the main character of your documentary. Can you remind me his name?
Austin,
yeah. Yes. Because he lives in a very small town, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the girls that are in the film, too, are dealing with the same thing. But Austin has it in his own way, where he was, like, made fun of at school and wants to get out of his town. It's, like, a factory town where, like, nobody, you know, there's, like, so much abuse in his family and mm-hmm. stuff. And he just wants out. And so I think that what is in the Heathers is everybody wanting out but feeling so stuck and so trapped that they want to kill themselves yeah. and that they want to blow up the school and they want to, like, shoot people and do all these yeah. horrible things.
There's just pent-up rage.
It's
inside.
So much pent-up rage, and they don't know how to get out at yeah. all. And I think that in Jawline, it's like the pent-up rage and the feeling victimized and all those things is still there for sure. But they are thanking the fact that they have these communities online for it not being worse.
Yeah.
And
it
for
could
not
be worse.
I mean, there's literally girls in the film that saying that were like, I was suicidal, mm-hmm. but I'm no longer suicidal because I found these boys. And it's like that whole suicide, like, train of thought was, like, everywhere we went in Jawline.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a marker of that time where you're yeah. kind of like, you really cannot imagine how you're going to get out.
Yeah.
And you feel like that's the only power you have. The only agency I have is over my own life.
Yeah.
I don't have control over anything else. And I think that relinquishing control is something that when you get older, you don't have to do as much. And so you're, like, kind of dealing with the fact that you have no control over your decisions as a teenager. And that is so difficult. And I feel like there aren't enough films or things out there that give credit to how hard that is. People
yeah.
kind of write it off. But, like, what about giving credit to, like, that is so difficult to have no agency.
Yeah.
And to feel like you're an adult, but you can't make any decisions yeah. for yourself.
There's, I mean, you're talking a lot about this kind of, like, the idea of suicide being in the air, too, you know, like this kind of cultural sense that, like, that's, you know, something that someone could ideate, you know, because they lack that agency and they feel lost. And, I mean, do you think Daniel Waters' approach of kind of poking fun at it and like, doing a joke, does that do a service to it? Does it, you know, to how hard it is? Does it detract from it?
I think it allows you to have, like, an outer body experience with it, where you're not, like, it's not your personal experience with it, where, and neither are the character. It feels like you're kind of looking at it in a way where you can only look at it as ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I also feel like he was kind of using suicide as something that, I mean, which I'm sure was grounded in reality at the time, too, where, like, many teenagers he spoke to talked about suicide and stuff. But he's also using it as this example for, like, follow culture a little
yeah.
bit. And I think that that was something that I connected to when I mean, I loved this film before I made my film.
Yeah.
So like I loved it for other reasons. And then I rewatched it and I just was like, the amount of follow culture in that film is what makes it so relevant today, because I think that, you know, we're the real critical angle of suicide culture in that film is how something that is like so extreme, like killing yourself, could become a trend.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he makes it sound ridiculous, but like, we should stop laughing.
Yeah.
Like, we should stop laughing in 2019, because I mean, there's stuff out there that are just like as dark as this that become like, you know, big trends and stuff. And I think that, I could talk about
fucking Tide Pod challenge. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And like, there's like a challenge where you choke yourself.
Yeah.
And like a couple kids have died from it.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, I don't know. It's also just something about, okay, like in high school, there's a lot of like following and, oh, a follower. Like I remember girls in my high school used to be like, well, she's not cool. She's a follower.
Yeah. Yep.
And that wasn't cool. But now we live in a time where everybody follows everybody else. Mm-hmm. And like you are literally following whatever, 1,000 people on social media.
Yeah.
And you are, you know, especially when like subscribing to apps and stuff, everything is about follow culture, where you are only on an app because everybody's on it.
Yeah.
Well, like you're only using an iPhone because everyone has one.
Yeah.
And I think that follow culture has gotten so out of hand that we don't even actually stop to think about it. It's just a part of our everyday life. And so when a film like that, you kind of think of all those girls in high school as like, oh, my God, look at them. Like, you know, or everybody in that high school, look at them. They'll just, you know, and if anybody says anything is cool, they'll just all do it. And it's like, well, look at us as adults.
Yeah, it's a weird social hierarchy order that we almost can't help but conform to.
Yes, exactly. And if you don't conform to it, I think that you lose. Like, it's like that's how society has made us feel, where, mm-hmm. you know, if you talk to like a friend who doesn't have Instagram and you're like, well, are you missing everything?
Yeah.
You know? Like, do you know anything about anyone that you've ever met?
Yeah, try to explain to someone who's not on Twitter a joke that was on Twitter.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you just feel like that person is like a complete alien, and it's like that is a whole like first date conversation. Like, it's like, oh, I don't have Instagram. Like, okay, like you two are going to talk for like 3 hours about mm-hmm. like why you don't have Instagram. You know, it's like, it's such a big deal right now to check out of any of these things or to be disconnected in any way.
Oh yeah.
And I think that, also even like when we would, so the film is shot in like 15 different states.
Yeah. Jawline is shot.
Jawline is. And, I would be in like a suburb in Texas, and then I'd be in San Francisco, and then I'd be in Tennessee, and I'm like, you guys all look the same. You're all wearing the same shirt. You're all doing your hair the same. You're all wearing the same shoes. You have the same little like a sticker on your keyboard or whatever. And I just was like having these outer body experiences of like the globalization of everything, where it was like it wasn't just like in a little high school anymore.
Yeah.
It was global, the follow culture.
That's the thing that really struck me, is all of these boys that looked to me exactly the same. They had the exact same haircut. They dressed the same way. They kind of styled themselves the same.
But it links back to the Heathers, though, because it's like if you want to be a Heather, you have to, where does it start? You have to look like a Heather.
Liza, thank you so much for coming and talking to me about Heathers and your movie Jawline. And how can people see Jawline?
Jawline will be on Hulu August 23rd. You could catch it there. It's going to have a theatrical run in New York and L.A. But, you know, most of you will just want to watch it comfortably from your couch. So I encourage that.
Get relaxed.
Yeah, get relaxed. Zen out. Watch Jawline.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at switchbladesisters@maximumfun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/switchbladesisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
If you want to with the eagles. You have to learn to fly.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.